You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There's new evidence of direct involvement by psychologists in coercive interrogation techniques that include torture and abuse. Psychologists are the only medical professionals that are participating in military interrogations, and that's the subject of a conference tomorrow at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice's Center on Terrorism. Joining me now are three conference participants: Dr. Stephen Reisner, who is running for president of the American Psychological Association on a platform of ending complicity in torture; Dr. Alan Keller, the founder and director of the Bellevue NYU Program for Survivors of Torture; and journalist Catherine Eban, whose article Rorschach and Awe on VanityFair.com exposed the role of psychologists in coercive interrogation techniques. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
What interrogation techniques are explicitly classified as torture under U.S. guidelines, Catherine?
Any interrogation techniques that are intended to cause psychological harm, psychological distress. But I think probably Alan Keller would be the best person to answer this specific question. You know, how American law is construed is a big debate right now.
And Alan, is a line drawn between what is torture and what isn't?
Well, I think this has been one of the real problems. The whole line or lack thereof has been turned on its head. According to the UN Convention Against Torture, torture is defined as severe physical or mental suffering inflicted for a variety of reasons by someone acting in an official capacity. Now, unfortunately, and I think to great harm and embarrassment to our country, has been ridiculous debate first about what that word severe meant. And as we know from these infamous torture memos, at one point severe was defined as permanent end organ damage or death.
Severe.
Well, it is, but I think we need a common sense approach. If it looks like torture, if it smells like torture, it's probably torture. The other things that have been happening that are very disconcerting is really a sanitization of torture, that by government officials, abusive methods that are clearly torture, such as waterboarding, sleep deprivation, exposure to painful stress positions and prolonged standing, have been referred to as, quote, enhanced interrogation techniques. And even the term waterboarding, it sounds more like a sport than really the horrific thing which it is, which is the terrifying and potentially life-threatening act of reenacting drowning. So these methods, regardless of what you call them, should be seen for what they are. They are torture. They are in violation of international law. And as a health professional who at our program at Bellevue and NYU has cared for several thousand survivors of torture, I can tell you the health consequences of these methods, both physically and psychologically, are devastating.
Dr. Reisner, until now, what has been the official APA policy on psychologists being involved in interrogations?
Well, the American Psychological Association has taken a position, for the most part, rather similar to the Bush administration. First, they, like the Bush administration, condemn any participation in torture or cruel and inhuman treatment. But like the Bush administration, the American Psychological Association has defined what those things are according to Bush administration principles. So first, the APA will argue that it's completely against psychologists' participation in torture and in cruel and inhuman treatment. But they believe that the interrogations under the aegis of the Bush administration don't fall into that category, and they're the only health professional organization that permits their members to participate.
Well, psychiatrists are MDs, and therefore they are bound by the Hippocratic Oath, but psychologists are not, and so they're not bound by the Hippocratic Oath?
Well, psychologists are not bound by the Hippocratic Oath, but they are bound by the ethical principles of the American Psychological Association, which also say that psychologists do no harm. In fact, the ethical principles go further and say that psychologists are mandated to do good and no harm.
So how does the APA reconcile that with its position?
The way they've been doing it thus far is they've been prioritizing the ethical principle B, which is a duty to country and to society, over ethical principle A, which is a duty to human welfare.
I would also like to add to that, the way I think they've separated is by what I would refer to as a moral disengagement, rationalizing their act. That is, for example, I think, as Steve mentioned, they are the only health professional society that permits their members to participate in interrogations. All others have come out of that. I mean, all ban torture participation. I will, you know, tragically, many health professionals, not only psychologists, have clearly been complicit in torture. But what the American Psychological Association has said is like, well, one, we have a useful purpose to by being in the room with the interrogators, and two, we actually may provide some level of safety by being a, you know, kind of a stopgap. But I think that is utterly ridiculous. I think they ultimately play more the role of somebody who is, you know, enhancing and increasing the likelihood, because, you know, the military interrogator is there and saying, well, if it gets out of hand, I'm sure the psychologist will say something. And the psychologist, who's there really at the behest of the military, may be quite hesitant and say, well, it's okay. So I think they become more enablers rather than a safety. And I actually, from a study that we conducted with Physicians for Human Rights, where we interviewed former Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo detainees, and that report can be found on PHR's website, phrusa.org, as well as our program's website, survivorsoftorture.org. You know, we found that there was tragically a lot of complicity among health professionals, including psychologists, in torture and abuse in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib.
Catherine, yeah. So is that where most of these psychologists have been involved in these interrogations, Guantanamo? Abu Ghraib, what about the CIA black sites?
Right. I want to make a distinction, because when I started investigating this, the first tips that I was getting is that the APA may have basically aided and abetted torture, because it had a panel that voted to permit psychologists to participate in interrogations. Then came up a big flurry of debate within the APA and among psychologists about whether psychologists should be permitted to participate in interrogations at all. And, you know, as an investigative reporter, what I was looking at is was very confusing picture, because a number of the military psychologists on the panel had been vocal opponents of coercive interrogations. As I began to look further into this, what emerged was the fact that the CIA had basically been running a psychological demolition crew of psychologists who had been the architects of these coercive interrogation methods. And these were being used at CIA black sites and then trickled down to Guantanamo, where there was no habeas corpus.
Wait, so they were not psychologists who were in the military? The ones the CIA was using.
Well, actually, they had previously been with special forces and military, but they were acting as contractors to the CIA at the point that I reported about them. This is James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. And it was a group of former SEER psychologists, and that was a military program to train soldiers to endure interrogation at enemy hands. So they had been military psychologists, but then basically what they did is they sold this bill of goods to the CIA, saying, we know how to make people talk.
Wait, we have to back up a bit. So these SEER psychologists had been training people to endure rough interrogations by communists. And now what we were doing is we were taking all those things that we had said were abhorrent when we said the communists did it, and now adapting them as our own approach?
That is correct. Basically, the enhanced interrogation techniques that were designed for the CIA interrogations by psychologists were reverse engineered from training programs to inoculate our own soldiers against stress.
Well, I'd like to just add to that, that in terms of where these techniques came from, and Catherine's article, I think, was just so crucial in bringing attention to this, as I know as your show has been. But these techniques, actually, I'm not sure that they were the original architects. My understanding, actually, is that a lot of these methods were lifted from a Chinese interrogation manual, which was really about getting false confessions. So morality aside, and it's a big aside, these methods are not effective at what they're set out to do. And they
You're saying that the Chinese manual was not concerned with getting real confessions. They simply wanted people to say, yes, I was involved in this capitalist plot to overthrow Chairman Mao and then either be executed or sent off to some re-education center.
Right. So those methods were borrowed from there.
Let me
just finish, Catherine.
Okay.
They were borrowed from there, and then they were applied, as Catherine had said, in the context of preparing our troops to withstand torture. So they were never developed, really, or intended to be used for getting at the truth. There's a saying in science, garbage in, garbage out. And that's what happens when you use these methods. You don't get accurate information.
Catherine?
Yeah. What I just wanted, when I said that these were the architects of these enhanced interrogation techniques, is that they basically were the designers and trainers for the CIA's use of these techniques on detainees in the War of Terror. Mm. So I just want to clarify
What I'd like to add to this is that actually what we find is that these SEER techniques were ubiquitous in the so-called Global War on Terror. You will find reports of these SEER techniques of sensory deprivation, stress positions, sleep deprivation, various forms of abuse in Afghanistan at Bagram in November of 2001. And then the CIA used them in a very codified way with two psychologist contractors. But then at Guantanamo, what happened is that word got out, there were some psychologists and other people in the military, the FBI was the most vocal, complaining about these techniques. And at Guantanamo, there was a battle. And ultimately, a program of interrogation that is still pretty awful, that still was considered torture by the International Committee of the Red Cross, was instituted and overseen, and it was instituted and overseen by a group of psychologists called Biscuits.
But there's been an APA moratorium on interrogation that was passed last August. It mandated a ban against psychologists serving in sites which are in violation of international law. Has that been effective?
In fact, it wasn't passed. It failed to be passed. The moratorium was up for a vote, and there was a debate, and Colonel Larry James spoke against it at the meeting of the Council of Representatives, and it was voted down. But it turns out that Colonel Larry James was the it was called Biscuit Number One. He was the chief psychologist supervisor of the interrogator advisors at Guantanamo during that period.
Well, if it was voted down, do you have any hopes of winning the presidency of the APA?
Well, there are two steps. One is that since it was voted down, the membership has called for a referendum. There were 1,000 signatures on a petition, and there is now a vote before the entire membership on the moratorium, asserting that psychologists should not be able to be present at sites that violate human rights and international law. So that vote is taking place this week, and I think that the membership actually stands independent of the leadership of the APA on this issue.
We're talking about direct involvement of psychologists in coercive interrogation techniques with Dr. Stephen Reisner, who is running for the president of the American Psychological Association, Dr. Alan Keller, the founder and director of the Bellevue NYU Program for Survivors of Torture, and Catherine Eban, who is a journalist. Her article, Rorschach and Awe, on VanityFair.com created quite a stir when it brought this whole topic to light. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We'll continue right after this. We're We're back with Catherine Eben, author of Rorschach and Awe for VanityFair.com, with Dr. Alan Keller, founder and director of the Bellevue NYU Program for Survivors of Torture, and Dr. Stephen Reisner of the American Psychological Association. Dr. Keller, can you tell us a bit about your group, the group that you founded? It was in 1995. Why did you feel there was a need for such a program at that time?
Well, you know, when I first started doing this work, I thought, you know, torture is a medieval phenomena, clearly not something part of our modern world. The way I got involved was through Physicians for Human Rights, who have a network of health professionals who examine asylum seekers claimed they were victims of torture. And at the time, I was working in the medical clinic full-time at Bellevue Hospital. And it was obvious that even, you know, after I wrote an affidavit documenting their abuse, they had a host of medical, psychological, and social problems. And so an extraordinary privilege came together with an incredibly dedicated group of health professionals, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, and a host of other colleagues who work with our program, who I think in their dedication are second to none, and started the Bellevue NYU program.
But were most of your patients from other countries? Or
yes.
Now we're talking something quite different.
Since we've started, we've cared for, I believe, close to 3,000 men, women, and children from more than 80 different countries. And we get anywhere from 5 or more referrals a week. And a lot of these individuals are from Africa, from Tibet, from wherever the horror spots du jour are. And let me just tell you about, you know, one individual we cared for example, a Tibetan monk who, because he had written some poetry critical of the Chinese government, during his interrogation, had his hands thrust into a coal-burning oven. And they said, because you're not doing anything good with your hands. And he came to our program and we provided him with medical, mental health, and social services.
Let me ask you what that means. Now, I understand medical help for someone like that, but what about the psychological impact, the long-term effects, of course, of interrogation techniques? What sorts of things do you see, and what kind of treatment regimen can you impose?
So first, I'd encourage your listeners to visit our website, www.survivorsoftorture.org, to learn about what we do. And I will say we are in very much need of support, because the demand for our services is far greater than our capacity. But with regards to the mental health services, we do several things. One, we really are very focused on symptom reduction. So when appropriate, we'll use medications. I'm always amazed that individuals come to our program who literally have not had a good night's sleep in months or years. We also use a lot of groups that we've found groups are very effective at helping individuals reconnect. So we have a French-speaking African torture survivors group that's led by one of my colleagues, Dr. Hawthorne Smith, an English-speaking African torture survivors group. We've had women's groups, and we find these groups just are really, really important. And then our program, both through program staff as well as by using psychology interns and externs, provides individual counseling. The horror is that these things happen. The good news is that there's a lot we can do. But it's important to realize that you don't have to lay a glove on someone for it to be torture and for it to have horrific health consequences.
Do interrogators also suffer mental health problems?
My sense is that in the aftermath that they do. At the time they're doing it, again, I think just as the American Psychological Association is doing, there is a moral disengagement. And by that, I mean that they are rationalizing and compartmentalizing what they're doing, saying, look, this is for the greater good. They're viewing the individuals who they're doing this to as something less than human. They're dehumanizing them. Otherwise, how could they possibly do this? And that then, again, the ends justify the means. And the chilling thing is, this is what I've heard from from the patients we've cared for from all over the world, that it's really for them was never about getting accurate information. It was about terrorizing and intimidating them. And so I fear, actually, that by in any way supporting these methods, we have made the world so much of a more dangerous place for those, the Tibetan monk or the African student advocate. And we're not really getting useful information, I would assert, from these terrorist suspects.
Dr. Reisner, Dr. Keller mentioned earlier that some people argue that by being involved, psychologists can prevent things from getting out of hand. Is there any way to ensure that a psychologist's involvement is constructive? And does your platform, as you run for the president of the APA, leave room for this constructive involvement of psychologists in interrogation?
Well, there are a number of problems that are raised in that issue. First, that the presence of psychologists has been used by the military and the CIA and the Justice Department as a way of giving cover to the legal responsibility of the interrogators. What I mean by that is that you and Bybee in their torture memo argued that if the interrogator consults with an expert and that expert leads that interrogator to believe that this will not cause long-term harm, then the interrogator has a defense against criminal charges and war crimes charges. So the presence of a psychologist has a political role. Now, can a psychologist who's part of the military, whose career is military, who's involved in an intense moment where the mandate from the White House on down is to get information, can that psychologist actually be independent enough to know exactly where the line is, crossing over into some unforeseen psychological harm or not? It's an untenable position for a psychologist to put himself in.
Well, my guests are doctors Stephen Reisner and Alan Keller, and also journalist Catherine Eva. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope. Catherine, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, which is this argument that that the government has made that having psychologists present at interrogations will make them safer was, as my reporting showed, was really only necessary once you actually wanted to make the interrogations more dangerous, so that the psychologist's role was to ensure that the use of dangerous or enhanced interrogation techniques did not get, quote-unquote, out of hand and wind up killing the detainee. If you don't want to use those enhanced interrogation techniques, you don't need someone to referee the interrogator.
Now, you spoke to psychologists. What was their definition of the how did they understand the Rumsfeld definition of humane treatment?
Well, you know, this is a very, very complicated question to answer, because the definition has been changing continuously. But what we do know is that there was an internal memo which basically laid out the use of these enhanced interrogation techniques at Guantanamo and is very careful to stipulate how dangerous or violent techniques can be used without inflicting fatal or severe harm. So clearly the idea was to calibrate the harm.
Look at what it's come to. Psychologists, who are health professionals, whose ethics code once asserted that our role is to do no harm and to do good, to support human welfare, suddenly we're becoming the policemen of the psyche. We're becoming some predictors of future trauma in a world of coercion, harm, and brutality. And it has turned the role of the health professional, it's turned our reputation and our reason for being the professionals we are on its head.
Now, the FBI had different ideas about what is effective in interrogation, and probably based on information that they got from psychologists. But it's not coercive. It's about making friends with the person you're trying to get information from. And many people feel that coercive techniques are tactically wrong.
Yeah, having spoken to a lot of interrogators, over and over again, I hear that the most effective methods are rapport building. Now, with regards to, I think it's important to make it real what we mean by health professionals being involved. And first, just referring back to the Rumsfeld memo you mentioned, there was an irony that I believe Mr. Rumsfeld scribbled on a piece of paper which said we're going to have detainees as part of the enhanced interrogation method stand for 4 hours. And he wrote on it, well, I'm on my feet for 8 hours a day. Well, context is everything. There's a profound difference between standing in one place and moving around. When you stand in one place, the blood begins to pool. You risk developing clots, which can cause pulmonary emboli. I've had patients who nearly died from these things. But back to the health professional involvement. Among the individuals we interviewed for the PHR study, for example, I interviewed someone who had spoken with a psychologist. They believed in confidence, about how stressed he was about being there and not knowing when he would see his family. And lo and behold, the next interrogation session he had beelined in and focused on that issue, whereas they hadn't focused on that before. So a clear example, I heard about doctors who would go and monitor individuals who were in rooms where it was very hot or very cold, to basically, as Stephen said, to calibrate their harm. There's been documentation of falsification of medical records, particularly in Abu Ghraib. And tragically, the list goes on.
Catherine, yes. How many of the psychologists you spoke to were in the military?
Oh, quite a few.
Were they concerned about going against orders because they are not the highest in the military chain of command?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. But a number of the military psychologists I interviewed were most appalled by the fact that they knew Mitchell and Jessen. They knew that they didn't have a shred of evidence, no studies, no data to show that reverse engineering these techniques to interrogate people was actually going to be effective. And so basically these were PhDs who were offering, in their view, a pseudoscience to the CIA.
But here's one of the problems. I think that there's a lot of research, and there's been a lot of CIA research done by psychologists, which shows that dependency, dread, despair, if you induce these terrible conditions in a detainee, hands-off abuse and coercion, you will actually get some response. The issue here is not whether if you freeze a detainee or whether you frighten a detainee by telling them that that some harm will come to their family. The issue is not just about whether that works in getting them to talk. The issue is whether psychologists should be doing any of this, and B, whether torture is torture, whether it works or not, and certain techniques and methods have to be condemned because of their inherent cruelty.
Now, in a joint poll by ABC and the Washington Post, more than half of those polled believe that the U.S. government is using torture in the campaign against terror, but over half of those people regard the use of torture as acceptable. And I wonder about why you think that is. There have been documentaries like Taxi on the Dark Side, To the Dark Side. There have been numerous articles and books. And yet the public, more than half the public, believes that torture is acceptable.
I think that the question of to contradict Dr. Reisner, I think that the question of effectiveness is very important because there is not a shred of evidence that you actually get useful information. I mean, as one of my sources said
except
to me,
Fox is 24.
You can get detainees to talk if you use these enhanced methods, but about what? Are they going to tell you the truth, or are they just going to say anything to make the torture
stop?
Are
you surprised that John McCain has changed his position on this as somebody who was subjected to torture?
Well, I think he's had a long, proud history of speaking out against torture. I have been somewhat saddened that he seems to have dampened some of his comments. But I think in his heart of hearts, he's still against this. But I think the point that Catherine makes is really crucial, that these methods, morality aside, are not effective. They were never intended at getting at the truth, and that they have devastating health consequences. And by the way, it's estimated that in the U.S. there are more than 400,000 survivors of torture from all over the world. And in New York, with its large immigrant population, probably has more than any other. So thus, the urgent need, for example, for our program's services. But we have just made, in addition to the morality issues of psychologists being involved, in maybe whatever small percentage of cases you got useful information, one has to ask, at the end of the day, have we made the world a much safer place? And I would say we've made it a much more dangerous one. I know that from my colleagues working in countries. And I think it's actually really auspicious we're having this discussion on September 11th. I mean, I was rounding the bend at the Lincoln Tunnel when the first plane hit the World Trade Center, and I ran over to the Bellevue ER, and scores of docs was standing around waiting to treat someone, and people didn't show up. They either died or got out. And as I know, your later guests on this program, Liz and Steve Alderman, who are dear friends, will speak to, that they took from that experience, not, yes, we should go out and torture, but that, no, we need to heal and make the world a better place. So that population that supports that poll, I think, is misinformed, as was, I think, the Bush administration, a la watching 24, that somehow, these methods are effective when they're not and when they're terribly harmful.
I think, too, that people make bad decisions when they're afraid, and that sometimes governments manipulate fear in order to pursue certain political and strategic ends. And the American people have been frightened by September 11th, and that the lesson to be learned is that we don't make our policy out of fear. We make our policy out of good experience. So, for example, from Nuremberg, we learned that you don't follow orders if the orders are to torture people. Yet the American Psychological Association's ethics code has a loophole in it that permits psychologists to follow military orders even if they conflict with the ethics code.
The conversation will continue tomorrow at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice's Center on Terrorism. And three of the participants have been my guests today, Dr. Stephen Reisner, Dr. Alan Keller, and Catherine Evan. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.